Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I, your weekly roundup of the top personal finance, consumer and business stories that editor Simon Lambert and his team have been covering on their award-winning website. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and joining me today is personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, we delve into the murky and mysterious world of credit ratings. What are they? How do they work? And can one bad mark really affect your employability? Also today, after a torrid few years for savers, we ask if ISA season is back, explore why hundreds of thousands of pensioners could face a tax headache, and find out what Rachel learned from being a Good Samaritan this weekend. Plus, it's time to stop being so British as Lee teaches us the art of the haggle. It could pay for your next holiday to the Royal Mint, IKEA land, all that and plenty more coming up. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. Enjoy peace of mind with our new guaranteed income bonds and guaranteed growth bonds.
But first, it's time to delve into the mysterious world of credit ratings. We all have one, and a good score is pretty useful when it comes to getting the best deals or being accepted at all for anything like a mortgage, credit card, or even a mobile phone contract. Given how often, though, we hear stories of readers losing out on homes because of mispayments years ago, some wrong, and even job offers affected, maybe it's time to become better acquainted with your credit rating and debunk a few myths while we're at it. So firstly, a very warm welcome to you both. Rachel, give us a credit rating 101, if you could. What is it? Who decides what your score is? How's it calculated? Who uses it?
A credit score is a number attached to your name, and it is supposed to reflect how creditworthy you are. So if someone lends you money, what the chances are that you'll be able to pay it back. And there are three main agencies who put together this number. The way they come up with it is all of the banks or anyone who lends you money reports to them on how successful you've been at paying that money back. Anyone who gives you a credit card, anyone who gives you a loan, sometimes mortgage providers will look at that number as well. When you take out a phone contract, that technically is considered a loan, so they will also report to the credit reference agencies. And from all of that information that is reported about you, credit reference agencies will come up with a number which is considered your credit score. It is pretty murky how they come up with that number.
And unhelpfully, they're not all the same, are they?
No, so one is, I think, out of 900 and something. Another is out of about 700 something. They don't all calculate it in the same way. And also, in the past, they've not been that upfront about exactly how they come up with your score. But there was a story on Wednesday in our sister publication Money Mail about how the number is calculated, with specifics like if you manage to keep your credit card balance below 30% of your limit, that boosts your score by 90 points.
Wow, that's specific. I had heard that, but I didn't realise how specific it was.
Yes, I mean, there's still sort of some ambiguity, and different factors will work in conjunction with each other. So you couldn't, I don't think, calculate your own credit, your likely credit score, by the things you know about yourself. There's still sort of, I'm sure, weird algorithms that are used, and it's all slightly more obfuscating than you might think it would be.
But the bottom line is, the better your score, the more likely you are to be accepted for things and to get better rates, right?
So exactly. So in turn, lenders, as well as reporting to the credit reference agencies, will also ask for reports on you to decide whether or not to give you a loan. And if you've got a high credit score, that means that it's considered you have a high probability of being able to pay back your loan. They're more likely to want to lend you money and they'll give you a loan. Or it's also used to determine what rate they'll give you. So if they think that you are low risk, they might give you a lower rate. If they consider you high risk, you might end up paying more, which makes sense in one way because they're taking on a higher risk. They want something greater in return. But it also means, conversely, that if you are struggling more, then you're more likely to be offered a higher rate of interest. And that feels a little bit unfair.
Lee, there are some easy wins. Can we call it that in terms of boosting your credit score? Let's get some of those out the way first. And the first thing I'm thinking is in the electoral register.
Exactly, yeah, that is the classic one. And actually, it's quite surprising sometimes how many people aren't on the electoral roll. And that's, according to Experian, that has the rating between 0 and 999. That would boost you by 50 points, which could be the difference between you getting a certain percentage loan or credit card and not. So it's always worth making sure you're part of the electoral roll, on the electoral roll. As Rachel points out, one of the biggest ones is having a card with 30% of the limit. If you have a credit card, I'll never forget when I was about 18, my mum said, you should get a credit card. And I was like, oh, why should I get a credit card? It's good for your credit rating. And I remember thinking,
Savvy of your mum.
Yeah, it sounds a bit silly, but she was like, if you get a credit card, to spend a little bit on it and pay it back each month, you get a kind of credit record along with having a mobile phone contract and that sort of thing. And actually, one of the biggest things experiences you can do is have a credit card and just run it properly. So if you clear the balance each month, that's another 60 points.
Well, the reasoning behind that, though, surely, is if you're thinking about lending money out, one, you want to know if someone's good for it.
Yes.
But if someone's got what they call a thin file, i.e. you're 18, you're 19, you don't really have any credit history.
Exactly.
How do you know? I mean, think about it yourself. If I was going to lend you money,
how
Lee,
you know
and
I'm
I don't know you.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not going to give you some money. So.
And that's how you slowly sort of build it up for the future. And I'll never forget my mum now. It feels like a bit of a joke. But she said, you know, one day when you want to get a mortgage, you know, it's going to be really helpful to have like a back catalogue of credit. And then, you know, it took quite a while to get a mortgage. But it is still sound advice. But as long as you don't get yourself into trouble with it, as I'll explain in a minute. But also not opening any new accounts for 6 months, so not looking like you keep applying for credit all the time and getting more credit cards. That's another 50 points. Holding the same credit card for 5 years is 20 points, which part of me thinks that that's not always great advice, because you might have a rate that changes, for example, and all of a sudden it's way worse than what it was, or you might have a card that has a short-term bonus or that sort of thing. So that's worth 20 points. And also the other one I was a little bit miffed at as well from experience, paying for your car insurance monthly instead of annually, which I know it's because if you're
paying... Is that good or bad?
Well, that's what I thought. We pay our car insurance annually, but apparently that's not the right thing to do according to Experian, because I guess
but
it shows...
But it's cheaper, surely.
It's slightly cheaper, and it shows you're good for it up front.
Yeah.
You paid for it up front, and I always presumed that was the best advice. But hey, Georgie, what do I know? Apparently paying for it monthly gives you a 20-point boost. And I guess it's just because it shows that each month you can meet the payment. But that one I'm a little bit not so sure of. Now, there are things you can do that damage your score, of course, and actually some of the damage can be quite severe. So defaulting on an account is a really big one. 350 points that can wipe your score off. That's a big, sizable number for, you know, a credit reference agency that uses a 999 scale. Getting a CCJ, which is serious enough as it is anyway.
CCJ, explain.
CCJ, it's a court county judgment. It's when you default on something and they can't, you're not good for the money, basically.
Yeah.
You can't
so
pay
you haven't
it back.
Been paying your bills.
Yeah, exactly. You haven't been paying your bills. That's another 250. And the thing is, if you've defaulted on an account, it's probably likely it's going hand in hand with a CCJ. And that actually then makes it very difficult to get a whole raft of products and can get you even deeper into the
market.
Oh, it really does. Yeah, county court judgment, I think it lasts up to sort of 6 years or so. It's a real serious thing that usually involves losing your house and that sort of thing. So you're probably your credit score is at least your worries if you're in those sort of scenarios. But actually missing a payment just once, so having a credit card and not meeting a minimum payment or for whatever reason. Sometimes people just make mistakes. They might get a new credit card and they might not have set up a regular payment in time or not ticked which box they want to start paying it back if it's the minimum payment or whatever. It's 130 points you can get damaged.
Also be careful as well with rent. I mean, I had this when I took over some of the bills and of course there was a missing month there and they blamed me for that.
And that's quite frequent, especially in rental properties. So it's always worthwhile making sure you're on top
double
of all that.
Check
and you got to double check
score.
All of this, Georgie, you really have. And then there's a few other things as well. So borrowing more than 90% of the credit limit, you know, that's 50 points. Having more than £15,000 on a credit card is another 50 points. I mean, that's really quite worrying, isn't it? Because they look at that and they think, well, that's a lot of debt to be having on a credit card. You're not really making provisions to bring this down. So then it starts making you look less credit worthy. So it was actually quite interesting of Experian to be more transparent than the other two. According to the report, you know, they were a little bit more willing to give away, you know, some of their formula of how they calculate these things. And it's
only fair. It's essentially your financial CV. It's the thing that's going to get you things like mortgages, credit cards. It's what everybody else looks at. And you are encouraged to pay money often to take a look at this. So you can get some for free, is that right?
Yeah, well, it's definitely changed a lot more. It's changed a lot in the last couple of years, where most of them now just offer them for free. There was a big change, actually. We were copying the system somewhere like America, I'm sure it was the States, where they ordered the credit reference agencies offer it for free. And I'm pretty certain that's what happens. Now, you have to sign up for a month's free trial, and then if you didn't cancel it in time, you'd have paid.
I think they still offer those, don't they? A monthly one, and the argument with that is they do fraud checks, and you can regularly check,
but it's a lot easier than it used to be to check your credit score.
Yeah, no, indeed. Rachel, the first advice then is to take a look at what your credit score is. Take a look at if there's any mistakes or anything that you don't recognise. There's also issues about being linked financially to someone. A lot of myths as well. So if you're renting, perhaps, are you linked with your housemate? Is it only if you get a joint account with someone? Let's debunk some of the myths around it.
So, yeah, the first thing, of course, is to check yours regularly. Make sure that there aren't any mistakes. They do creep in. It's just stupid things like sharing the same name with someone. Sometimes mistakes can crop up that way. In terms of other people's scores affecting yours, they shouldn't do unless you share some kind of product, I think. If you share a mortgage together or something like that. But if you're housemates and your housemate is not so good at keeping on top of their finances, that shouldn't really make a difference. Mm-hmm. Someone else at your address should not have an impact. But so often things can just creep in that you don't really find out about until you're trying to do something important, and then you get stung, and that's when you find out that things have gone wrong. Can I have a minute to mention British Gas just once more on this?
Yeah, go for it.
Oh, it's 2 years ago. I'm still so angry.
Explain, Rachel. Come on, take us back. Thank God, because in my head just then I was about, is this the time when I have to tell everyone that I had a bad credit score for back at university because I missed a payment on a crochet magazine? So please, let's talk about British Gas.
Okay. I think we'll have to go back to that, actually.
Let's not.
Deep breath. British Gas.
Right.
I moved into a house with a prepayment meter. I didn't want the prepayment meter. I have to tell you, there are a few things more embarrassing I found than having a friend stay over who goes to try and take a shower and it's freezing and you realise that the gas isn't working. And you tell them that they've got to go across the road to top up the prepayment meter. It's not cool. We had this prepayment meter for a couple of months, and then I phoned up British Gas and said, could you please change it? And they said, yes, no problem at all. Let me just run your details, blah-de-blah, check with the credit reference agencies. And they said, oh, sorry, declined. I had just moved into the house, which meant that a lender had agreed to give me a sum of money that I will not be able to pay back for the next 30 years. It's that big. Someone thought I was credit worthy, and yet British Gas decided that I wasn't. So I said, well, what can I do to contest this? I'm fairly sure my credit rating is pretty clean at the moment. I'd cleaned it up particularly to get this mortgage. And they said, oh, you'll have to talk to the credit reference agency. So I phoned them up and they said, no, we don't know. It's British Gas's decision. There's nothing that we can do. And British Gas said, well, you just have to wait for 6 months, 6 months with this prepayment meter, and then you can try again. I tried again. It was declined again. And I honestly do not know how you get out of that catch-22 when the credit reference agencies blame British Gas. British Gas blames them. No one. It's all done by algorithms. So there's not a person who's actually looking at your finances and deciding whether or not they think you might be able to pay a gas bill every month. I have to admit, the only way I got myself out of this was by phoning the press office.
I was going to say, yeah.
And I hate it.
I'm a financial journalist, did you know?
I will never do that until... But I actually didn't see that there was another way out of it.
Wow.
I don't know what people do.
What did they say in the end?
Terribly sorry. We'll change it straight away. But there was never any explanation as to what was flagged on my account, whether it was someone else who used to live at the address or what it was. I don't know. They wouldn't tell me. Thanks for that.
Yeah, thank you. Stop me talking about crochet.
Yeah, about crochet.
No, but it does. You know what, Lee, I'm going to just mention it because I was talking about it yesterday with the complaining cow. Mm-hmm. I've not called her that. She calls herself that. She's on Twitter and she's literally written the book about complaining. It is so frustrating when we have situations like this. We all do, all of us three here. Mm. And it is so easy for us to go via the press office to kick up a little bit of a stink and it will be sorted out very quickly. But what about everyone else that cannot do that? I actually said to her, we should say one of our big tips for complaining is just call the press office. Mm. I won't, obviously, any press officers listening. I'm really sorry I wouldn't say that. But it is, say I'm a financial journalist because you get results. It's so unfair for everybody else.
It is. I always, if I ever have a problem, you know, actually in my own personal life where something like that happens, I would never just go straight to the press office. I would make sure that I've gone through a proper complaints procedure and make sure that, you know, they've done everything to rectify the problem before it gets to that point. It is really frustrating when you have to then go to a press office to get the result which you know is correct. And that's actually, you know, what we do as financial journalists, and that's why we have so many readers get in touch. Where they can't seem to make headway, you know, for whatever reason, that's why we take on the case and start getting involved. Telling people, Georgie, to start phoning up press offices, I don't think it's going to be a very popular move. And they will ask for, you know, accreditation.
I've never called the press office to ask what publication you work for. I've never called the press office, I have to say, in my, and I never would as well. They work very hard, so I wouldn't want to add to that. But there is an important issue with that, is if you do spot any errors or anything on your credit rating, there is something you can do. It's not just a situation you have to sit tight for 6 years. You can actually have a notice of correction on it, right?
Exactly,
and I did do that, and it was done very quickly and I didn't even once say I was a financial journalist.
Yeah, it can happen quite quickly. And, you know, in large amounts of time, you know, companies do honestly do the right correct thing. And it's just those times when they don't, and it's very frustrating and you can't get them to see sense. But, yeah, there is a process in which you know, they will happily take a marker off, you know. But the thing is about that, it depends if it's put you into some sort of financial hardship in which you wouldn't have necessarily found yourself in if it wasn't for the fact that this marker was on your account when it shouldn't have been. So that's when you start saying, you know, well, how are you going to compensate me for, if it holds up its hands and says it's made a mistake, how's it going to compensate you?
Well, talking about that, there's an article on your website, which you've written, I believe, Lee.
Yeah.
Can it really impact on job offers? So you talk about a reader who lost two job offers because of a mark on their file that they say they didn't know anything about. Now, I remember us talking about this on this very podcast, that nearly 2,000 job applicants, and this was back in November, I think, had been turned down for roles in the previous year after background checks had revealed that they had bad debt. Now, is this the same thing? Tell us more.
It's broadly the same, but it's not quite the same. So basically, those 2,000 job applicants, what happens is, if you're especially getting a job in the financial services industry, they'll do background checks on you to make sure, A, that you don't have bad debt, because, you know, the argument is if you go into work for a financial organisation and you're in bad debt, it might make you do something fraudulent, you know, and you might not be trusted with important financial information. Now, the firm that does this is called CIFAS, not-for-profit organisation, which it says exists to reduce and prevent fraud and financial crime. It's kind of like another process that employers go through, especially in the financial service industry. So they might get an Experian credit check to look for that bad debt. This CIFAS is more for if you've acted fraudulently in the past. So what that can mean, there's been a big rise, for example, last year in money mules. So 18 to 24 year olds especially, you know, give over their bank account details, get paid a little bit of money.
Students being targeted.
And what happens is the criminal then uses that to money launder. And if you get caught, you then end up with a CIFAS marker on your account. The bank will close down your bank account, and it's very, very difficult to get a current account for the next 6 years, because that is on your folder for the next 6 years. So that's what a lot of students now, if that happens, they get caught. It's very hard to then build up a financial profile. Now, in this case that I've written about, it was a contractor, so freelance, but he had a full-time job with a certain bank. He got interviewed for another job with another high street bank, passed the interview, said he had the job, just a compulsory background check. So he quit his other job. You know, not always the best scenario, but he doesn't think he's going to foul the background checks. I mean, what could possibly come up? But anyway, he does foul. And they wouldn't tell him what it was they found on, other than that they'd used Experian and CIFAS to run some checks through. So he was on the electoral roll, and he thought maybe it was that, and whatever. He applied for a second job. Again, went for the interview, went fine, did the background check. Again, they came back saying, do not employ. That's quite a galling thing, isn't it? To come back and say, do not employ.
Yeah.
So he kind of asked, you know, can you point me in the direction of what? It's the second time this has happened. What is it? And they told him it was something on his CIFAS file. that's all they could tell him, really. So he contacted CIFAS and they told him it was from a Bank of Ireland mortgage application. So to cut a long story short, he was buying a buy-to-let property, £53,000 he needed to borrow to buy a property in Belfast. The first lender he went through for his financial advisor said that it was too small amount of money to lend on a property. The second lender said that the property was the wrong height, so it's likelihood that it was a flat and it was too many stories up. Third one was Bank of Ireland that he went through, and they just flat turned him out, and he didn't know the reason why he'd been turned down. The next week, he secured the money and he bought the buy-to-let property, and he also remortgaged on his own property, and there was nothing flagged up, so nothing happened. Fast forward 18 months later when he's applying for these jobs, and he finds out he's got this marker from the Bank of Ireland. They're saying it's from undeclared commitments. So what that means is that he's applied for a mortgage and they're arguing that he didn't reveal his full financial status. And what they're saying is that he'd hidden one credit card from them or something. But he's got all the proof that he sent the documents, the statements, all of his credit cards. He's got it all in a folder. And when he contacted the Bank of Ireland and asked for them to take it off of his folder, they said, yeah, fine, we'll do that.
Which is in itself a little bit of a worry of how quickly they did it,
And that's what he's saying. You know, his argument is, well, how can they like affect people's lives this, you know, quickly? And then just go, oh, actually, we can take it off. But they've said they went through the right procedures, the correct procedures, and it deserved to be on there. But they won't go into any more detail. So they've pointed him to the Financial Ombudsman, which it's currently at. So the Financial Ombudsman is now looking at this case to see whether Bank of Ireland done everything in its powers to put this on his folder correctly. But the interesting thing is that they don't have to proactively tell you that they've put that on your account, on your name. So he didn't know it was there. He might have never known it was there. It was only that he applied for a job that happened to use CIFAS as a checker because of the job that he was going for, that he knew it was there. So he was never proactively told it was there.
Also, it's rather extraordinary as well to think that, say he had hidden a credit card, that one, it would have that much bearing on a mortgage, which he got the money, I thought, eventually.
And remortgaged his own property.
Yeah, that it's that serious and it can then impact whether you're viewed as a fraud risk and therefore not get a job because you might not have mentioned you've got a credit card.
It's incredible. And the thing is, I gave Bank of Ireland a full platform to tell me what had happened and, you know, even off the record, just to tell me, you know, what information had it had that showed, but they refused to comment. And the thing is, it's got the proof that he sent the statements. And also, I'd be very surprised if this guy would get in touch with a financial media organisation if he wasn't telling the truth and also taking it through to the Financial Ombudsman. And that's the crux of it. And it's very worrying that that can go on and to not be proactively told. I did actually ask CIFAS, who've actually been really quite open and transparent about how it works. And I'm actually meeting up with them next week to talk through more of these processes.
Well, they'll have an update on the show next week.
Yeah, we quite possibly will do. But they say that when you apply for something like a mortgage, you're given something which is called a fair processing notice. And what this does is it explains that if the bank or the lender sees that there's fraud, they've identified fraud in whatever way, they will attach that to your name, but they don't have to proactively tell you that they've done it. And it can last 6 years.
So how can you find out? Rachel, have you ever heard anything like this before?
Yeah, there's an increasing number of employers will look at CIFAS is, I think, is more sort of if you're going for a job with financial services, but lots will just look at your credit rating. And that, I think, is really tough because you can get yourself into one of these horrible spirals whereby if you're in debt, it's harder to get a job, which means that it's harder to get out of debt, which means it's harder further still to get a job. You can see how people's lives can spiral in one direction or another so quickly. And the other tricky thing is it is often at times, like when you're applying for a job, that you discover that you have these blooming markers or things flagged up on your credit score. We've seen cases before in the past where people have lost out on homes that they're trying to buy because they can't get a mortgage because they missed a payment on their phone bill about 3 years earlier. And you can never quite pin it down to that. You can never say that create that direct a cause and effect because, as we say, credit scores are kind of murky. They're algorithms. They say that there are lots of different factors that are taken into consideration. But you can certainly, I think it's fair often to speculate that there'll be one specific missed bill that will have such massive ramifications for someone's life.
Lee, while the advice is always be proactive, check your own, is this area ripe for a bit more transparency, a bit of a clean up, can I put it that way?
The trouble is, and what banks will especially argue, is that these markers sometimes can be quite sensitive. You know, I've had cases in which banks will close down your current account without much explanation, point to the terms and conditions, and because they've got grounds to believe that you're acting fraudulently, and they don't want to reveal the full details of how they believe that you're acting fraudulently, in the fact that it might be money laundering, and they don't want to give away the details and too much. So that's the argument with some of this stuff, but there definitely needs to be more transparency. There's a point at which Bank of Ireland, you know, they turn you down for the mortgage, which is frustrating, but you know, it's up to them, that you can choose who they want to lend the money to. But surely in that same breath they can say, by the way, you've acted fraudulently in this case, so we've got grounds to believe we're going to have to put a marker on your name to flag up other banks and building societies not to lend to you because you've acted fraudulently. Why is there no step to sort of explain that?
What about innocent until proven guilty?
Exactly.
Having a chance to defend yourself.
Well,
right?
This is it. No, Georgia, I absolutely agree with you. In this circumstance, you know, he believes that, like, perhaps a page has been missed off of facts, or some easy mistakes happen. And it is. Why is he being told that he's guilty before being proven innocent? I think it's definitely an area that I'm going to keep looking at and keep probing. And I'm going to meet some of these senior people at CIFAS next week and get some answers.
Tooley, well, keep us up to date on that. Now, let's move on, because you two often write about fraud. And unlike the reader you've just spoken about, there are genuine crooks out there. And I imagine, I hope, that you don't often speak from your own experience of it. But this weekend was different. Rachel, you were seconds from being witness, I understand, to some poor gentleman, elderly gentleman, having his card stolen at a cash machine in broad daylight. Now, what was worse, if it can be, was that he was a visitor here from another country. And one can only imagine just how scary that is, being in another country when you don't have your cards, you don't have money. OK, so take up the story for us. Tell us what happened and why you decided you wanted to write about it.
So I was walking down the high street last Saturday, and I heard this chap was shouting out, "He's got my card, he's got my card." I was with a couple of friends, so we stopped to find out what was going on, see if we could help. What had happened is he had typed in his PIN to take out £100 from the machine, and someone had come up behind him and said, "Oh, the machine's broken," and pressed cancel on the transaction. And somehow, in sort of commotion of it all, the criminal must have taken his card out of the machine and quickly pocketed it. And before the old man knew what was going on, he disappeared with his card. And we found out later, and suspected at the time, with his PIN number, because he'd watched him type it in over his shoulder. And so then this left this elderly gentleman, who's visiting for the weekend from France. It was unfortunately the only card that he had. He was staying in a hotel around the corner and didn't have a method of paying for it. I think he had €100 in his pocket, but no sterling. So my friend took out money so that she could switch it for him, so at least he had a bit of cash on him. But it was quite a palaver working out how he was going to pay for the hotel, get himself back to France. Then it was, of course, a bank holiday in France, so his bank wasn't going to be open till the Tuesday, and blah-de-blah, and it was a complete nightmare. But it occurred to me, we helped him to phone up his credit card company to cancel the card, and then we phoned up the police, who were wonderful, came round within an hour. What I started to think was that actually it was inconvenient, his card being taken, but the money would be refunded. He wouldn't be essentially left out of pocket. The inconvenience probably could have been largely mitigated had he just planned a little bit ahead. It made me think, how many of us do that? I know that I probably don't a lot of the time. If he had just had a spare credit card, for example, in his room, if he had to hand the details of his bank so that there wasn't a big scramble around trying to find out what that was. And it feels very urgent, you know, when you know that someone is out there with your card and with your PIN number trying to take as much money as they can before you cancel your card. Those minutes really matter. So if he had had that on him, just sort of a little bit more planning, then it would have been significantly less inconvenient. I think lots of us don't think about that there are, of course, the best thing to do is learn about every single scam out there, go on to thisismoney.co.uk/beatthescammers. That's Lee's page, and where he tells us about every scam that we hear about. And that's the best way, of course, to keep yourself immune to them. But scammers are clever. And there's a scam out there for everyone. There'll be some kind of weakness that you have that in time there's a chance a scammer will find. So then in addition to that, I think it's important to make sure that should it happen, you are as protected as you can be. So having backup. And then the second thing is banks will generally pay out if it's not your fault, if something goes wrong and it's not your fault. When they won't pay out is when they think that even inadvertently you've been complicit. So if you have handed over your PIN to someone, if you have put money in someone else's account, they won't. And so they're the sort of things to really look out for. If you can manage to not do those, then if something does go wrong, if you are scammed, the chances are you'll get your money back. And while it's annoying and upsetting, you might not end up out of pocket.
Lee, my brain is whirring because I'm such a cynic, going, well, what if the man himself was a scammer? What if he was trying to... all sorts of things.
I do know what you mean.
In terms of this sort of crime, we often talk about online crime, but it just serves to remind us actually the old school ones are still out there.
Yeah.
And actually, I understand that this is not the first story that you've covered where tourists particularly are being targeted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there are still ATM cash machine scams. You know, people can fit skimming devices into where you slot your card in. That's a classic one. And they'll watch for your PIN. They'll clone the card, use your PIN, go and take the cash. I had one for a relative a couple of years ago. He was in Southend High Street. He was in Barclays. He was using the cash machine. Someone told him he dropped a fiver on the floor, and you're kind of all confused, and your card's in there. You know, bent down to get the card, get the cash off the floor. Didn't think he had a fiver, but you kind of, you know, you just pick it up anyway. And they'd swap the card, you know, out of the machine, and then they'd taken his card. Seen his PIN number, and he went on a bit of a splurge. You know, but the relative in question managed to realise pretty quickly that it was a card that had been replaced. Went to the counter, and it was resolved, you know, within days. But you do have to be on your guard, and especially if you're at a cash machine. You know, there is always that advice about covering your PIN, but it's true, you should cover your PIN. It's not that there's all sorts of different ways that someone could then get hold of your card and start to defraud you. So just be vigilant. If in doubt, use a cash machine within a branch. Probably a little bit safer. There's some eyes on you if your branch is still open. That is, and just be really vigilant. Don't get distracted. They call it distraction for a reason, because you know there's all sorts of little clever ways. And if a stranger does sort of come up to the side and you say, oh, you dropped a £5 note, would you turn around? I probably would. It's very hard to sort of stay static and focus in on what you're doing but you have to be rude and you have to ignore people. And tourists are a big risk, because, you know, let's say we were on holiday and it happened to us. I mean, do you have the telephone number for your bank written down somewhere? I mean, you haven't got the card because the card's gone. So have you then, what if you've run out of battery on your phone? Well, you can't phone anyone. So you're going to have to get back to your hotel pretty quickly and figure out how to get the phone number for your bank and then phone up. And by that time, they might have taken money out of your account. I'm not trying to put you off your holidays or make you, but it's worth staying vigilant. That's what I'm saying.
Rachel?
Tourists are targeted in particular because they tend to go around with a lot more cash on them and don't really know the rules so well, so it's much easier for them to get stung. So the police were telling us that there's another one that's really popular at the moment, whereby someone sort of a bit scruffy looking will go up to a couple of tourists, maybe sort of, you know, hassle them a bit, and then pretty much immediately afterwards, two more official looking people will come up afterwards and say, is this guy hassling you? Is he trying to mug you? Is he trying to sell you drugs? And they'll say, quick, check your wallet. Check you've got everything in there. Look, I'll do it for you. And then they'll rummage through the wallet, and they're so quick that they'll always leave a little bit of cash so that it's not noticed straight away. But they'll pocket most of it and then hand back the wallet, and then they're gone within seconds. And then it's only afterwards, when the tourists are sort of thinking, what was all that about? Look through their wallet and they realise their money's gone.
Happy holidays, everyone.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings, backed by HM Treasury.
Whatever happened to ISIS season, like Christmas in March, April time for the overexcited personal finance journalist? But alas, in recent years, the offerings have been less Santa, more Scrooge rubbish. Falling rates and the new personal savings allowance that came in a couple of years ago mean many savers have been left wondering, well, what is the point of sticking their money into a cash ISA? But, speak it softly, could ISIS season be back? Now, Lee, I remember years back, one of the earliest episodes of our humble little podcast, you had to explain to me the excitement of ISIS season. I remember where you were sat. I remember the look on your face, slightly rouge, as you do when you get excited when you talk about IKEA land and the like. I have never forgotten. So remind us, ISIS season. That used to be a thing.
That really did used to be a thing. But gone are the days where we used to have sort of Halifax adverts with Howard saying, ISA, ISA, baby. There's no more of that anymore, Georgie. The last couple of years, I'm afraid, it's been there's been no cash ISA season. So cash ISA season, what it was, especially around about between the years of sort of 2010 and 2013, banks and building societies, just before the start of a new financial year, which is in April, would clamber over each other to try and offer the best rate on their tax-free ISA to attract cash in from savers to, you know, fill up their books before the end of the financial year. And then also, when the new financial year then started, there was a bit of a battle for cash as well. So cash ISAs have been very popular. They've been around now for almost 20 years. People see them as a good way to shield their money from the tax ban, and rightly so. They are good products. But what happened was, there's been a couple of things that have sort of conspired against ISAs. So firstly, we had the funding for lending scheme, and that basically, essentially, pumped banks and building societies, if they so wish, with cheap lending, so they don't really need to rely on savers anymore to lend out, you know, then to lend out in the form of mortgages and etc. But that scheme has now slowly come to an end. So that's trigger number one as to why there could be more of a cash ISA season. The other thing that's also happened to cash ISAs since April 2016, there's something called a personal savings allowance has come in. Now, what that means is if you're a basic rate taxpayer, the first £1,000 of interest you earn on your savings is now tax-free. It wasn't previously. And for higher rate taxpayers, that's a smaller £500. Now, for 95% of people, it's very unlikely they're going to get more than £1,000 of interest. A, because they don't hold enough cash to get that much interest.
How much would you have to have saved?
Well, that's exactly the point, isn't it? Because, you know, if you've got £100,000 and you're getting a percent on it, I mean, you just about qualify for it. So it doesn't affect that many people. And that's why lots of people have now shunned cash ISAs, because the rates are slightly lower than you can get on a normal savings account. And you don't have to pay interest on you have to pay tax on your interest anymore. So what that's done is it's killed the ISA market a little bit, because fewer people are bothering to have one. But they are still really, really worth having. And yes, cash ISA rates are low, so your easy access and your fixed rates, they're a bit lower than your traditional accounts, but they come in all shapes and sizes now. You've got other ISAs that have launched. You've got your stocks and shares ISA. You've got your lifetime ISA, which, okay, we've only got one provider doing that, but you've also got investment versions of that. You've got the innovative finance ISA, which is where you can invest through into peer-to-peer. The limit's up to £20,000 now. I mean, it's far higher than it used to be. So you've got a new allowance every April of £20,000. If you have been saving into an ISA for a very long time, that's when it starts to get interesting, because if you've been maxing that out, the likelihood is you are going to tick over that tax amount, especially higher rate taxpayers, because let's not forget £500 is the maximum interest they can earn tax free. Also, it's very unlikely now that ISA wrappers will just, you know, one day get, no, you're not doing this anymore. You know, it's been a very popular product by the government. That's
George
why
Osborne loved it, didn't he?
Lifetime ISA. And this is all these ISA helped to buy ISA. All these things come out. And because there's been so many ISAs, it's kind of, it suggests to me, especially something like the lifetime ISA, you can't exactly turn around 3 years' time and go, well, no more ISAs. Well, it's not really a lifetime ISA, is it? I mean, it makes no sense. So it's way more likely that the personal savings allowance, if there was a change in government or, you know, for whatever reason, it's way more likely to get axed. So
that's the one that they're going to fiddle with, as opposed to
It's much more likely. I'm not saying that they would, but it's much more likely. So it means that it's still really quite worth having an ISA, even if you just open one, you know, for the new financial year with just like £100, you then still can use, you know, it's worth doing, in my opinion. It's still worth having an ISA. Now, what could be interesting next month is if we start to see a few little competitive ISA rates come on, because a lot of challenger banks are focused on the fixed rate market in the traditional savings world, so not tax-free products, not ISAs, and that's because they're more expensive to run. There's more red tape. There's more sort of behind the scenes that has to be done for a provider to have an ISA, right? So they're not as sort of financially viable for a new challenger bank. But if we start getting a few like bigger high street banks getting back in the mix, I mean, Halifax and Santander used to be hot in the ISA market. They used to, you know, there was like a golf ISA if Rory McIlroy won the, you know, an Open, you know, you got a bonus and that sort of thing. But the rates were very good. You know, we're talking 3-4% and decent rates. So if we can start seeing some bigger providers start going up the table a little bit, and it could have a knock-on effect to others and competition might get a bit better, it might take probably more like next year. I reckon next year we're going to see a way bigger ISA season than we'll see this year. But this year we'll still see a bigger one than we've seen in the last couple of years because it's just...
Well, that's not hard, though, is it, really?
It's not hard. It's not hard at all. But even if you think that a cash ISA is not for you, it is worth also considering a stocks and shares ISA, which is just an investment version of it. And I know our editor, Simon Abbott, is a big fan of those investing DIY type ISAs. Worth looking into.
How hands-on do you have to be for those, Rachel, the stocks and shares ISAs? Because I think a lot of people turn off by the idea that, oh God, I can't be bothered. Like, oh, I don't really understand it, or, you know, that sort of thing. Can you just put your money in and let someone else do it? I mean, how do they even work?
You can do as much or as little as you want to. There are some providers that work with these kind of those sliders, you know. So you just say how long you want to put your money in for, how much money and how risky you're feeling. And they'll go and find the investments that fit your profile. Or you can pick your own or a combination of the two. You can get started with someone else doing it for you. And then once you realise actually just how interesting it is, then you can start to do it yourself. Even that is not that difficult. Picking some funds out, all of them have descriptions. The platforms try to make it as easy as they possibly can for you to do that. And so it can be an interesting thing to do.
The first step, I guess, into the investing world, maybe.
Yeah, why not?
Why not, indeed?
But as a caveat, only if you can afford to do it. And ISAs are a brilliant idea for, certainly for building up your initial nest egg, a wadge of cash that would last you if you're out of work for a few months and tide you over.
A little buffer or something, yeah.
Exactly. And when you've got, you start to accumulate, if you're lucky enough to, money that you can afford not to touch for 5 years or so, then that's time to start thinking about stocks and shares ISA.
I do want to ask Lee, if it's possible as well. We spoke about the Chancellor, the former Chancellor, George Osborne. There, another product he rather enjoyed was his own pensioner bonds, wasn't it? But we were warning recently, weren't we? I remember when they came out, goodness me, that time was almost up on the 3-year bonds. But you're warning that 900,000 savers will soon face a tax nightmare as a result of this. Firstly, before we go into that, what were pensioner bonds?
Pensioner bonds, Georgie, were issued by National Savings Investments. They're actually called the over 65 guaranteed growth bonds, but not quite as catchy as pensioner bonds. They were ruddy popular. I mean, I can remember Mr. Osborne sitting on the sofa on BBC News saying this has been the fastest selling British financial product of all time. So
we've probably said more about the environment than it did about the
I wouldn't be getting too excited about that, Mr. Osborne. I mean, it was as people were struggling to find somewhere to put their money into, especially pensioners that tend to have, like, you know, lump sums and they rely on a monthly income, and, you know, savings rates have completely crashed and couldn't find a return. So these two products were launched. There was a 1-year version that offered 2.8%. There was a 3-year version that offered 4%. Up to £10,000 could go into the account. Now, I think there was over £10 billion flowed into these accounts, a massive amount. And what's happened now, we're 3 years along the line, so those are starting to mature now, those 3-year bonds. And it's given people a headache. Firstly, it's given people a headache of, well, you know, we've had this rate for 3 years, 4%. You're not going to be getting anywhere near that on a regular savings account now, on a normal savings account. The new Chancellor, Mr. Hammond, launched a product last year, which I've completely forgotten about. I can't even remember the details of it. It was so poor. You could put £3,000 in, I think, get 4% perhaps. I can't remember the full date. No, no, it wasn't that. It was about
wasn't
2.
Even near that.
No, it was
2.3
or something, wasn't it? Yeah. So I mean, I must get onto the Treasury again to see how those are selling, because they've not given us many updates as to how popular those have been. But the other complication with this is the tax implications of this. Now, I think the majority of people, I don't think it's going to be anywhere near 900,000 people, if I'm being quite honest with you. Most people don't qualify for this. What it is, if you open the account between January and April the 6th, so we were talking earlier about the new financial year, so new tax year is on April the 6th. Now, if you open one of these accounts before this, you know I was saying earlier about the personal savings allowance of £1,000 or £500 for basic rate taxpayers, that kicked in April 2016. So for some people that opened the account between January and April, they were on sale until May. But if you were like one of those early birds, you're more likely to be trapped into this, right?
Right, yeah.
Because that first year, you would have been taxed on the interest at 20%. So what Money Mail, our sister title on Wednesday, were arguing here is that you need to check if you've overpaid on your first year of interest. It won't affect year two and year three because the new personal savings allowance was there. But they reckon that some of those first year calculations may be incorrect, and it's worth having a look through your paperwork to make sure that you haven't overpaid. You've been taxed on the interest when actually you might not necessarily need to be. And what you need to do in those circumstances, and this is when savings used to be quite complicated and quite convoluted and frustrating, is when you have to fill in something very annoying on the HMRC website, a form to say this is why you shouldn't have been paying interest on that savings total. So it won't be anywhere near 900,000 people that are affected by this. But if you did take out a pension or bond between January and April 2015, it is worth checking that you have got the correct interest.
Why do these things have to be so complicated, Rachel Love?
I know. Well, I'm really sad because the current Chancellor, Philip Hammond, has just announced that his spring statement, which used to be a massive extravaganza, one of the highlights of my year, is going to be
A Tuesday or something, isn't it now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to be a totally low-key affair, and he's not going to change
anything.
Isn't
that a good thing, though?
And it's a good thing for pretty much everyone except for us.
Personal finance journalist.
Because I really enjoy the excitement of it.
It's all right, we've got ITIS season coming up. You get excited about that. Yeah, no.
Yippee.
No.
Not quite the same.
But for everyone else, it's probably great news because you don't get yourself into these stupid predicaments whereby a product is introduced, then a rule is changed halfway through, then it's not HMRC, it's not the tax man or politicians who have to go through and smooth out all the wrinkles. It's blooming pensioners who have to go and phone up HMRC to claim back their bits of tax that they've been charged that they shouldn't have been. It all just gets a bit messy and complicated. And while it's perhaps done with good intentions, it does get a bit messy. So maybe it is good that we get, 6 months off?
Little break, yeah. Finally, Lee, I absolutely love the start to your latest article. Quote, I had a moment while sitting on the sofa earlier this week, you say, Lee, when I thought, I'm sure we bought our car around 2 years ago today. Is the insurance up soon? So, Lee, tell us more about your sofa moments.
I will tell you all about my sofa moment, Georgie. So, basically, earlier in the week, I was going through some old paperwork, and then I thought to myself, well, we moved into our new house almost 2 years ago. And just before we moved into our new house, we bought a brand new car. Say, Brad, it was a used car. It was a year old. And I thought to myself, well, surely that means insurance must be up soon. But we hadn't had a renewal quote come through. So usually you get a renewal quote through onto the mat. You look at it and you go, they're trying to charge us how much? Mm. Why has it gone up so much? We hadn't had any of that. And I started to think, oh, God, what if it's run out or we're about to run out? I don't want to be driving the car illegally. Anyway, I found a bit of old paperwork that said this was on Monday. And then I realised that it was going to run out on Friday. I was like, oh, wow, we've got like 4 days. So my partner, Danielle, who uses the car every day for work, for a short commute, I was like, Dan, I think we might need to be thinking about shopping around for some car insurance.
Quickly.
So anyway, she's a much better haggler than me. She really does love a haggle. She will go into the shop and haggle or be on holiday and haggle. Haggles everything, loves a haggle. And I really enjoy it. And I sometimes get a little bit embarrassed by it, but I secretly quite enjoy it. But anyway, so she phoned up the insurer. And she's been with the same insurance firm for, since she's been driving, so a good 13 years or so. And they turned around and said, oh, yeah, it's due on Friday. We've sent out a renewal letter. Well, for whatever reason, we haven't got it. And I'm not saying that they haven't. They've got it on record that they sent it out. But for some reason, we didn't have it. She was like, yeah, it's going to be £1,100 for the next year. Now, you know, years of no claims. Just absolutely crazy.
That's
price. More than double from last year, yeah. Right? So that's an incredible amount of money. Nothing's changed other than another year of both of us safely driving on the road. So I couldn't understand that at all. So Danielle's on the phone, and I could tell she's getting a bit stressed about it all, but she's a good haggler. So she's going, well, what's your best price? I'm a loyal customer. I've been with you for years. I'm not having it. It's ridiculous. So the lady on the other end of the phone's going, well, car insurance costs have gone up 14% across the board this year. Well, that's 50 quid.
Do you want to tell me?
Yeah, that's about 50 quid. If you can work out percentages, you know that's about 50 quid, right? So it's just not good enough. So anyway, while she was on the phone, I was on a comparison website. And this is what you're going to do now. You have to play the game. So I type in all our details. Danielle since hang up, and we're looking. I'm looking, putting all the details in. The third cheapest quote is from the same insurer online. So you just think, my God. 350 odd quid or whatever it was. So it's gone down from 1,100 to like £350, right? And I've reduced the excess.
I can just imagine your girlfriend's face.
Yeah. So I reduced the excess from like £500 to zero. So that's better for us. And I increased the mileage to 5,000 rather than 4,000 miles. So for those little tinkerings, you expect it to be a little bit higher, but it was still so much cheaper. Right. So anyway, Danielle's now got a bee in her bonnet. I mean, she is I'm going to stick it to the man. I can't believe this. You know, she's getting really animated. I'm loving it. She phones up, gets through to a guy now, and he was, you must have put in some different details. I'll compare your quote that you've got from the comparison website to the quote we've just done, but you must have typed in some different details. So, okay, about a minute later, oh, actually, no, it's exactly the same, other than you've now got a lower excess and more mileage. Yeah, we can do it for you for this price. So the moral of the story is, because we hadn't had the renewal letter and I hadn't really been prompted into doing it, if we just left it to today, to Friday, and we hadn't done anything about it, it was just by chance that a light bulb went in my head, we would have just auto rolled onto that £1,100 instead of 350 quid. So to celebrate, we booked some flights to Sardinia for a nice little summer holiday. And do you know what? It put Danielle in a good mood. She was like, I really feel like we've conquered something today. We've really sort of like made a difference to our financial life. And I agree with her.
So it's the double bonus, isn't it? Of one going, yeah, I'm proud of myself, and two, you got yourself a holiday.
Exactly, yeah. I'm happy with that, Georgie. But it's really frustrating because you know the reason that they do this. I'm not just talking about car insurance, but other forms of insurance as well, is that they offer cheaper deals to new customers to get them through the door, and then they punish loyal customers that have been with for a while and trust you and hope that you kind of almost trip up and make a mistake like that. So they can then, you know, completely give you a totally over-the-top, ridiculous price. And the worst thing is that some people who maybe don't have the internet, you know, 1 in 10 households don't have the internet, so they might not have the facility to look at a comparison website. Danielle tried to haggle without us looking on the comparison website, just on the
got
phone.
Nothing, yeah.
We haggled some off, but it's still nowhere near as much as what we haggled
so
from a comparison website.
When the insurance companies have a go at the comparison website, and you think, yeah, because they're calling you out.
Yeah, exactly that. And it's... I don't know where it all ends, if I'm being honest with you. I mean, it just seems absolutely crazy that it can get away with such a massive price discrepancy between those two. I mean, it's incredible. We've basically saved almost 70% on by staying with the same firm, but just crunching the figures through on a comparison website for 2 minutes.
So bad. We always say it, don't we, Rachel? Loyalty doesn't pay. Is the time right, though, that actually, come on, as we get more involved in customer service, people are getting more switched on, more savvy... It's not all down to price as well. Loyalty has to start paying somewhere, doesn't it?
I don't think that we've really seen any signs of that yet. What ends up happening is it's people, as Lee says, who maybe don't have the internet who end up paying the more. So this cross-subsidisation of those people who are more savvy by those who maybe are older, so they don't know how to use these price comparison websites, or they don't have the internet at home. For different reasons, it'll end up being those who are less able to pay who end up paying the most. And it really stinks. You would hope that at some point, as you say, that there'll be a tipping point, that people will say, I'm sick of being ripped off, and it will do some kind of brand damage to companies who take this too far. But they're still trying to rinse it for all they can. I think most of them still.
But it annoys me because it just makes me think, if I'm going to get a bee in my bonnet now, but, you know, if companies are telling people, oh, you must have put something in wrong, how many people must have gone, oh, yeah, do you know what, you're probably right. But maybe I have. And they ask lots of questions, don't they, on those sites.
I found an old insurance document, so I could see exactly like how many claims years had been on that document. I could see how many miles. So I knew exactly what I was, it wasn't like I was comparing apples or oranges. I could see that it was completely the same thing. It's just crazy. But I will tell you another story, actually. A couple of weeks ago, I got our renewal quote for contents and buildings insurance. And actually, that had come down a little bit. I was quite surprised. So I got the renewal quote through, and it seemed really reasonable. So it seems to have come down a little bit.
Something you're agreeing with there, Rachel.
Yeah, you're right. Gosh, maybe I'm being too harsh. I had the same thing. I got my renewal quote in. I love getting a renewal quote because I get all ready to go. Get out. And it was thoroughly disappointing because it had gone down. Yeah, it was cheaper.
Good old insurers. You don't know what they're planning. No. Yeah, what's their game?
Who knows? Well, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes and tell your friends and family?
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, giving you the chance every month to win up to £1 million tax-free.